Port of Port Townsend to order for today, August the 13th. And we'll go right to the agenda, which is, first up is yard policy.
This is just a continuation, just want to bring you up to date on some of the actions, you know, if we want to discuss any other things regarding yard policy, we can certainly do that. The main thing is a letter will be going out this week to all the tenants in the yard. As we discussed before, it's already in our regulations that you're supposed to have liability insurance in the yard. And Doug has been enforcing that here these last several weeks as we haul boats out. And talking to Shannon, that really has not been that big of an issue. You know, some grumbling here and there, but everybody's pretty much gotten their insurance together before we haul them out. Where we are, though, we have the boats that are in the yard that have been in the yard. So we're sending a letter out. And this is what will be going out. And it's the same liability requirement of $300,000 that we have in the marina. And I'd like to think that as time goes by, virtually all the public marinas require liability insurance now for mortgage. And more of the private marinas are coming on board with the same thing. So as you get more boats covered, this should be less of an issue as boats haul out in yards, wherever they are, whether it's our yard or somebody else's yard, because they'll already have that insurance. But we've got a few boats that have been here for quite a while, and we'll see what the owners respond with. But so this will be going out in the mail this week.
So is there anything that we can do to help some of these people, correct them in proper options for insurance,
yeah,
so they're not just left trying to figure this out?
We did this with when we first implemented the mortgage requirement. We put a list together of insurance companies that provided that sort of insurance. Just like anything, we can't be in the government. We shouldn't be advocating, you know, one insurance company over another, just like we don't tell people to go to this restaurant versus another restaurant. But we thought of doing that and having that available in the yard office if people aren't aware of that. So
in the event that it's like a major restoration project, say it's, for example, it's a boat that's it comes on a trailer. You know, it's like, you know, a complete basket case that somebody's got the wherewithal and wants to spend their money here and hire marine trades and whatnot, put the scene back together, and they can't get insurance. Is there?
If they try and can't get it, I would think on a case-by-case basis we can review that. And
yeah. So we don't eliminate that type of activity here.
I'm just
concerned about eliminating that kind of activity here, just like that tugboat was getting rebuilt out there.
Right, and I think we can handle those on that case-by-case basis, where if they're showing progress, we know that XYZ Marine Trade has got the project, and if a Marine Trade has taken on the project, the Marine Trade has liability insurance already, you know, if it's one of our tenants, because that's part of the lease, and so that would cover them in that case.
Only on their property, though.
If it's on their property. Yeah, and if it's not, then I think we just review it. And
are you thinking that, like, if a boat comes in on a trailer that's a restoration project, it would be hard to get liability for it?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, and I think I told you about how I got through American Family Insurance on that boat,
right?
Without a survey, you know, how long if that's gonna that kind of thing's gonna last? I don't know. No.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, something along those lines. Does our insurance carrier, I mean, is there anything that we can do in regards to our own insurance carrier where that they would, like,
we cover somebody else under ours?
Yeah.
I really don't think so.
It's a risk pool.
Yeah.
Because it's not a insurance company that we, it's Endurus that does, you know, like half of the ports in the state, plus a lot of the cities and counties are.
Well, that's kind of my question is,
government.
Is that something that they could possibly, I mean, where we would actually charge this patron an extra fee for them to get it, you know, be underwritten by that?
We can certainly ask them, but bet you they'll probably say no.
Okay, it'll be worth asking.
Well, since this letter's going out this week, maybe we should get that list that you suggested we might get and really get it. So, and have like your American family and see who else is on there, so that, you know, when it does come out, somebody's gonna come in and say, ah, why don't we get this? I know I would.
Yeah.
And so it'd be useful to have that information available when this letter goes out, so that we'll be able to look like we're forward thinking.
Is this a good time to further the discussion of tenants?
As far as some of these older projects that nobody's worked on?
No, I mean,
Before we change topic, Joe, do you have something about that last thing?
Yeah, oh, okay. If it's appropriate, if it's okay. I don't know, in addition to maybe a list of available insurance agencies that they can use, I don't know if it would hurt to put an explanation in here that $300,000 insurance is about $50 a year. It's not a huge
right.
amount of money that, you know, and so a lot of people just don't understand. They hear the $300,000, and it's $50 a year for that level of insurance for basic liability. It's not that big a deal. The second part of my question would be for a company such as myself, where I have a lot of huge crafts and aluminum wells and these little boats that come in on trailers, whose insurance, their homeowner's insurance, basically covers them because they just launch at the ramp and then come back out. Well, with those, I use my equipment to detrailer them and put them back. So the port equipment isn't involved other than just the tarp, you know, in the area that they're at. Is there gonna be maybe an option to look at what kind of coverage do those people need to have if they're a trailable boat that doesn't sit at the dock?
I would think their homeowner's insurance is that more than adequate.
Yeah. Okay.
And there's a lot more than just trailer boats. There's a lot of other boats that can be covered on the homeowners.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to just further the discussion of the tailgater liability.
Independent contractor.
Sorry. Yeah.
You know, we've talked about it numerous times over the years. We've never enacted that.
Right.
I think we're probably the last yard that doesn't require some sort of liability insurance.
Right.
You know, from people that are using, you know, the infrastructure to make money on. So that's, I think if you ask Carolyn or you can ask me, I think we're hanging out there from a liability standpoint to some extent. You know, even though everybody signs a hold harmless agreement, that doesn't prevent a third party from suing everybody. And they'll always sue the port because we're perceived as the deep pocket. You know, so the independent contractor hits somebody with their vehicle, you know, or causes some property damage, or somebody walking through the yard trips over their equipment or whatever, you know, there is liability risk, you know, for us out there. But have we had a lot of incidents? I can't say that we have had in the 15 years I've been here.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the whole insurance game. You know, my house has never burned down either, but I got a lot of insurance to cover me in my case, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think too, like Joni was in to visit me, we had a, she led the charge on this years ago, and I kind of reviewed all of her information. It seems like there's a question about, is the insurance out there at a reasonable cost? And we were gonna talk to somebody like Jim
Mulpin, a couple others, yeah.
See if what the cost is.
So have we done that?
We have not yet.
He was on vacation.
Yeah, he was on vacation.
Oh, okay.
He's on the radar.
Yeah.
What, Joe, you got any thoughts on this?
I don't know. My insurance, when I first started, was, and I didn't have employees. I wasn't a corporation. I was just subcontracting all of them. It was about $1,800 a year, I think. And then it went up to about, it's just under $3,000 to be for my corporation to cover all my employees and
right.
stuff and have $1 million.
Yeah,
it's not crazy.
Yeah, know? The employees is a big factor,
yeah.
The whole change.
Yeah, the more employees you have. But it was also, that's another thing is if you're, I don't know, I mean, you're Keith, okay, and you've got a business license and you get your own insurance and you're doing work in the yard. but you've got three guys working for you. If you're subcontracting and using them as labor and they're not employees, they'll have to carry that same level of insurance. Yeah. So that's why I went the other way and went, well, my guys don't work and I have to be able to pay $1,800 a year insurance. So I just made the employee. It was way more frugal choice, but it's not that bad. I mean, for everything I do, I pay under $3,000 a year. It's not bad.
But for one guy working for Keith, if he's...
It wouldn't financially make sense.
Right.
You know, because Keith's hiring sporadically as he needs him, so it's a real on-call type job, and unless he's doing all kinds of other work, it's not worth paying that much money.
And I really heard there's a handyman insurance, which is at a lower level, much less expensive for somebody that's like helping Keith
like
out.
Something part-time. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Like you'd hire to come into your house to fix...
Or like somebody mowing lawns or whatever.
And that's the other big factor. I've done some internet searching on it. And most of the insurance companies will have a series of questions they'll ask the business owner. You know, because it depends on the level of intensity of the business, the type of equipment. Obviously, they're in the liability and risk business. So if you're using real risky types of equipment and techniques, then your insurance will probably be more expensive than if you're just sanding bottoms of boats and painting them.
So that's kind of a good number, the $1,800, $2,000 number.
Yeah, I mean, that's $1 million, you know. I mean, that's
right.
The minimum that is required.
Right.
I can check if you want me to and call my insurance agent and ask them, what do you do in a case like that? Or if I decide I don't want to be incorporated anymore and I want to subcontract, what are the options for my guys?
Yeah, that'd be because like Joni was saying that, you know, it really is, I mean, you reach a number where it isn't worth being in business if you're...
And if you're somebody like her, they start with $20 an hour, that's a lot of hours labor to pay your insurance every year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important that we have that because it was brought, you know, forth when Dan Braddon, who fiberglass forever, you know, since he was in the womb,
that's harsh.
He ended up leaving some rags and they caught on fire. I mean, he's a really good guy. He's and you don't think it's a real big thing, but you know, that can happen. And that can happen to even Joni. You know, she could have a phone call where she wins a lottery and she forgets to take her rags and unbundle them and they could catch on fire. So, I mean, there's potential liability that I think that even though there's not a lot. They're not doing real dangerous things like Hogan, you know, still, there are things that could happen. So I think it's really...
But you think the cost of the insurance would be less
right.
in that case than in Bertram had it.
Yeah. Bertram?
I was thinking that also it's possible that she might be protected from any liability from the tailgaters if you have very clear guidelines for what, in your best practices, if it also includes... some safety things, and if people sign on that, it might create a wall that would protect the port from a liability from a tailgater.
Actually, we talked about that a couple of days ago, Al and Eric and I, when we walked around with Brad, with the L&I guy. I don't know if it would protect us from a lawsuit, but it might lessen incidences from happening. We're thinking about coming up with another form, you know, for everybody to sign in the yard. For example, scaffolding. According to L&I, the minimum width for scaffolding is 18 inches. You walk through the yard, and there's people with all sorts of jury-rigged scaffolding, you know, standing on a 2x6, you know, 6 feet in the air and everything else. And
I'm here.
Yeah, I know you've never done that. Yeah, so we're thinking, you know, have some kind of safety best management practices that you sign, that you're aware of this, and you'll use these while you're on port property and in the yard and stuff. So I don't know.
So does that put, how does that work? So I'm a boat owner, and I'm standing on a 2x4 with a couple of stumps on either end doing my deal, which I've done before, and I fall... Am I supposed to have insurance to make sure that...
Well, we're not going to cover you.
Or, I mean, I have somebody working for me and they fall.
That's the key.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or you kill yourself, and now your wife is saying, well, geez, the port should have not allowed my husband to do this, you know.
Yeah.
You know, where does it go from there?
So, have we come to any conclusions?
I think we could, why don't we talk to Mopin and a couple others and get a better feel for...
You'll talk to your guy, Joe?
Yeah.
Give us a little feedback on that.
That's Mariner's Insurance.
You know, get a range of, you know, what would a Jomi-type operation theoretically cost, you know, ballpark figure versus, you know, something with cranes and...
Well, how about sending an email-type letter to the Marine Trades Association?
I told them I'd like to investigate their input. Bring this up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
CJ.
Deep question. I bring my boat into the yard next week. I'm here for 2 weeks. Something goes horribly wrong two or three boats down the line. Tailgater's working on another boat. Catches fire. Two, three, four boats catch fire. My boat eventually burns. Who am I going to? Tailgater has no insurance. I'm coming to you. You realize that? And you got no recourse. You got absolutely no recourse. If you're allowing contractors to work in the yard that do not have liability insurance.
So you're saying, CJ, that if you're saying our hold harmless wouldn't work in that situation?
Wouldn't carry a drop of water.
Okay. Because the tailgater started the fire.
As long as you had permitted someone to work in the yard, performing services in the yard, that wasn't properly insured, you're hanging way out there.
The hold harmless would prevent the tailgater from coming after the port. It would do nothing as it relates to third parties.
Yeah, so I think it's something we really need to institute as soon as we get, you know, open back from vacation and stuff like that.
Good point.
Thank you.
Keep a good fire extinguisher nearby.
Yeah. Or two.
Are there any?
Yes.
Yeah.
There are.
I just walked all the docks last week and checked every fire extinguisher.
But in the yard as well?
In the yard, too.
I'll bring them home.
Okay, so well, is that all in the yard policy? If so, we'll go to level 3 response financials.
Al and Amy put together a spreadsheet here that's being handed out. I think you got it on your iPad, too. Showing what has been spent and what is projected to be spent, realizing just like anything that we have to go out for bids on, we won't have the exact cost until we actually get those bids back, et cetera. But I think this gives us a pretty good feel for what we're looking at. Al, if you want to walk us through it.
Certainly. So in table 1 to the left, I've broken out the work items regarding the level 3 response and then cost estimates for work pending, which is shown in green, and above that, the cost to date for those work items. And then table 2, which is probably more where we'll focus on this morning, kind of aggregates those work items together in terms of cost to date, pending response costs, the estimated incurred and pending costs, and then what grant revenues, how much that offsets those costs. So this is all the level 3 response cost to date, first element under table 2. These are the best estimates based on the general ledger detail report for what those costs were. I've aggregated them in terms of equipment, materials, contract services, and port labor. A couple of notes on that. For contract services, we've estimated a percentage of Landau Associates, our engineering firm, of their cost to date. We picked 33% of those costs to date from Landau being attributed to level 3 response work, and then half of the cost for stormwater sampling through TWIS Analytical, the laboratory that we use for stormwater sampling. And then for port labor, note there, that's base pay, actual base pay, but that does not include benefits.
Yes, it does.
Okay. That does include benefits, but it does not include A&G costs. So A&G costs, again, for the pending level 3 response costs aren't attributed there as well. So you can see our total spent to date, our best estimate of that is $51,113. And then for pending level 3 response costs, for equipment and materials, I should note that is the best estimate less the cost for the replacement shipyard gravel, which is, if you look down at the bottom of table 1, the shipyard resurfacing project, which is underway presently. I didn't factor in there the material cost there. That's aggregated under the next line for contract services. We don't have a known quantity of material that's going to be going back. It will be more than the material coming out, owing to the fact that we've had some material loss over the years, and we want to bring the grade in that shipyard area back to the design grade. So that's going to mean replacing more gravel than was removed. We've got a pretty good rate on that. I think it's $65 a ton on that, which is a pretty good rate. So moving down to contract services, that includes the Vault 1 construction, or Vault 1 sand filter replacement project, I should say. That's the construction costs that are noted under the Vault 1 sand filter replacement element under the work pending column in Table 1.
That's the Sims Way?
No, that's the in-boat yard sand filter that we're going to replace. We just got the green light from the Department of Ecology on Monday. They approved a request from the port to deviate from the proposed level 3 response for that work element. Whereas before we had begun initially to investigate replacing that sand filter with a poured in place concrete trench and a grading system, mm-hmm. and fill that with filter media. And the engineering cost on the material cost for the steel grading alone, prefabrication, was $138,000. So needless to say, we put the brakes on that and put our thinking caps on and tried to reimagine how we might still meet those benchmark goals with an alternate solution. So we developed an alternate proposal, and we just got approval after 10 weeks from Ecology on that one on Monday.
And what is the alternate?
The alternate is a piping ground with catch basins.
Okay.
So substantially
above ground biochar filtration.
That's right. Post stormwater RX system biochar treatment in a tote configuration. Okay. So.
So probably, you're talking about like perforated pipe underground, so that it's like French drain or what?
And catch basins that will continue to, you know, pipe the stormwater away. We'll just have to be careful in the design and placement of the catch basins to where they function properly, but it keeps to a minimum the disturbance of how we can place boats in the yard. That's right. And you don't want to put a boat right over and then put a tarp over the catch basin. So we'll have to be mindful of that.
So is this going to do away with the swamp behind the co-op?
It will.
Yep.
It's been a key focus of ours is to solve for that problem.
So the sand filter is really going away, and you're replacing it with a pipe that takes it to the stormwater RX?
I mean, what's there now? It's going to stay there. It's going to be just left buried, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, no sense of wasting money digging it all in.
Right. So it will mean bringing more material on site to bring that grade out. We're going to, for the leg of that sand filter that now goes behind where the co-op typically stages its boats, we're going to move that out approximately 20 feet into what used to be a street right-of-way. Of course, with the land swap with the city, we have vacated that, so now we can place, you know, our stormwater controls within what used to be that street right of way. So we're taking advantage of the flexibility we have there in site placement now.
So if you hadn't been successful in getting these grants, we've been looking at $500,000 on this point, right?
That's correct.
Is there any other grant opportunity?
Not that we can see. Yeah. No.
There might be some, and I know a couple of us, two or three of us, are going to the environmental seminar coming up this fall, and you know, a lot of the WPPA associate members, which are the various consulting firms and other state agencies, we just need to keep probing and see what monies are available out there. And I keep thinking we need to call CURB, Community Economic Revitalization Board. It's the money that we borrowed to do the heavy haul out back in the late 90s. And they have some grants, they also have some very low interest loans for infrastructure, as long as you can prove that it's for economic development purposes, which I think
this would be easy for that.
Right, make a strong case here. So, but it's one of those funds that WPPA constantly is trying to encourage the legislature to protect. But it's one of those funds that the legislature, when they need money for other things, they keep seeing this pot over here and they keep dipping into it. So we never know how much is going to be available. But anyway, I think there's some other avenues that we ought to explore.
So how's this being accounted for? I mean, is this $428,000 estimate down here, I mean, is this a capital, is being accounted for as a capital expenditure and being put into the depreciation schedule and so on?
Well, actually, as we're developing the 2015 budget, that's a big topic for discussion, which elements of this would be considered capital and which
one
would be
considered. Why
wouldn't
all of
you
consider capital?
I don't know.
Yeah, we certainly could. You know, at the end, it is what it is as far as the number of dollars we got to spend. The other big question is, once this is done, this is a one-time thing, but because we're putting in the infrastructure, you know, such as these catch basins and pipes, well, obviously they're going to have to be maintained over the years. So just the level of maintenance, you know, does that stay in the environment, or does we flip that over to maintenance as an ongoing maintenance cost? You know, the same with the totes and the replacement of the media. You know, is that to become, it's going to have to be replaced, that we count that as maintenance or environmental? You know, we need to talk through all that and come to an agreement. You know, it's still got to be done. You know, just, you know, where do we put it on the balance sheet? So.
The project.
First of all, I applaud the commission for doing this study and this workshop. I think it's great. This is what we'd like to see. I have a couple of comments. One is that it's important to know how much you spend because it's going to, and if you can capitalize it, then you can depreciate it, and that is money in your pocket. And so that it's important to get the whole picture. I think that development costs are certainly a part of the whole capital project. And the Landau alone, you have spent in 2011, 23,577, 2012, 2003, 136, and in 2013, 24,738. And those are all, those reports are all related to the level three for the state and as far as plans. And I would think that could come up to $50,000, and that should be included in the cost of this project as work completed. And also, I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Alan, I once said at least 60% of your work in the last year has been on level three.
That's true.
And so that would need to be included in the development cost as well. You have 12,000 and
That's under the cost of date, under pending level 3 response cost. The way I projected poor labor was right now, what I've done is on the work list that I've got, I've compiled estimated staff time per work element. And currently that's tracking at 0.6 FTEs. So on that line item for poor labor, for pending level 3 response cost, I figured 2,080 hours, 1 FTE at 0.75, which should also incorporate some of the additional staffing that's going to be spent on that from other staff members to assist me with that. And I just figured a loaded rate, average loaded rate between those staff people at $30 an hour. So that's how I came up with that $46,000.
But I'll talk about from 2013.
For 2013, I was just using the general ledger report that I had available.
Well, I would think that it would be important to include, or at least investigate that, because that's money in your pocket, that all that land now development costs as part of level 3. So those are other costs.
Bert, can you tell me how that's money in your pocket? I mean, I believe you, but I just don't understand it.
Well, it's depreciation. I mean, it's depreciation. That's money.
But it's not real money. It's not...
We
don't pay taxes, right. Like
that. In this case, it's not real.
Yeah.
It really isn't. It's because we're a government.
Well, it seems like the question keeps coming up about how costs are tracked. And in this case, you know, this being as I asked before, why wouldn't this be a capital expenditure? Is this coded separately from all costs associated with this level 3 response? Are they coded separately than other environmental expenditures?
They're all labeled level 3. We are setting up a WIP at this point so we can start putting them all into a WIP so we can...
I don't know what a WIP is.
Work in process. So it'll all... So they will all be captured separately, yes.
Separately. So, but to date, they haven't been. Is that the case?
To date, they haven't been. They've been coded on the invoices, so it's easy enough for me to go back through on this 12-9-32. I went back through every time sheet, and that's actual level 3 time and benefits.
Sounds like a lot of work.
It really wasn't. So there hasn't been that much at this point to where, but there will be.
So in the future, you have separate coding then, that's what you're saying?
Yes, there will be.
Well, not just, we had this discussion with the supervisors yesterday at our weekly meeting, with all projects. We'll just do a WIP number to better track all that. And, okay. Whether it's fixing a roof or,
I just wanted to complete my thoughts on this. The other thing is that by understanding how much the scope, the entire scope, it helps you plan how you're going to budget your money. For example, as an aside, for example, the ramp expansion, I've heard some of the commissioners say that they really want to spend $100,000. Well, they've already spent $40,000 of that in just the development cost. So that, does that mean you're only going to spend $60,000 more to make the project go? So just as an example, it's important to know that, in fact, you have probably spent $500,000 on, you're going to be spending $500,000, and you have a 15% contingency. So just, it's important to know how much the whole thing has cost so you can figure out in your budget how you're going to capitalize it, and where that money is going to come from and how you're going to make plans to accommodate that. And the final thing that I wanted to say was that in talking to Amy doesn't know whether something is capitalized or not unless she's told. And so it'd be important that whoever's involved makes sure that that's clarified to her what is capitalized and what is not.
In a government situation, Amy, what are the benefits of capitalizing something?
Really, you're just following. I mean, the rule of thumb for federal capitalization is equipment over $5,000. So it just depends on that level that we you know, want to take. Some governments have taken a $10,000 and then it just shows up as an asset and you're depreciating it over the life of that asset versus expensing it.
Right.
You know, so it's really just the general rule of thumb, you know, $5,000 to $15,000, anything over that level is what
so
you would
an
normally...
It's an actual asset, a physical...
Right.
You can actually touch.
Right.
It's not well,
that's the case here.
So.
I mean, that's what this is.
But the depreciation schedule doesn't give us any benefit in terms of, like, a write-off. If we were...
No, because we don't pay taxes or anything, so it's just...
What is the advantage of capital? I mean...
Well, you have to capitalize assets,
right.
You know, over a certain dollar amount. So just based on general accounting.
So what's our discussion revolving around? In other words, we're talking about, well, do we want to make this a capital expense or not? And if it doesn't make any difference tax-wise, if it's capital or just anything, what's the, what does that mean? CJ, maybe you.
It all comes back to planning. We've talked about the 2015 budget. Some of us have complained that there isn't really a current budget, that it's just a bag of money that's being grabbed into. But the main point that I wanted to make a moment ago is that when you start talking about staff time, everyone northwest of this line right here is on salary. It's the same thing year after year after year, unless you should decide to decrease or increase staff levels or the number of commissioners or whatever. That's a constant. No one gets overtime or any substantial amount of overtime. That category of administrative expenditure should be predictable, more or less constant. It's increasing certainly some. But when you start charging staff time to projects, you distort that account. What happens to a year when you don't have any capital projects and everyone has nothing to do? All of a sudden, you have this huge lump of administrative and general labor that is not chargeable to anything else except overhead. So you need to quit fooling around with the books, with the smoke and mirrors of charging people and staff time to various projects. They're all in one account. It's the same thing, year after year after year. Hard costs go into capital projects. Hard costs, including outside engineering, outside consultants, track things like that. But your costs, don't try to allocate them. It's silly. It's really silly. This comes back to the overall budgeting and planning process that you need to implement. And it's the first place you need to start with all those costs right there and the support for those costs. Then you can start talking about your 2015 budget. The use of depreciation in this instance is attractive because you can use your depreciation schedule if you properly depreciated an asset to predict a replacement time for that asset and the next increment of when you might need to further capitalize equipment or capitalization for new equipment. I'm done. That's all I'm going to say today.
I personally totally agree with that.
Yeah, I do too.
And we have limited.
As a business person, CJ, I'm right with you. I mean, we're, you know.
There's only one slight change because with some of the agencies like the FAA that we deal with, where they come to us with their money and they pay for like 90%, and we have to come up with 10% of the cost. They allow us to count our labor costs as part of our contribution rather than actually writing a check. So there are some individual projects where we do need to keep track of our hours just so we can, it doesn't affect the budget, but it helps us not write a check to the FAA or whoever. Those are, you know, individual
do an allocation within the books.
Right.
But you're right, whether I work 40 hours or 60 hours this week, I get paid the same. It doesn't matter. And
they're too busy handing out money. They don't have time to look at the details. Just do an allocation.
Yeah.
It's a good point, CJ.
Thank you.
Understand it clearly.
And definitely things like we buy a new pickup truck, we need to kind of plan when we're going to have to replace that. 5 years, 10 years, whatever. So you appreciate it.
And we have limited those allocations more so than what they had been.
Yeah.
So.
I have one other small comment to follow up on Larry's point about the maintenance. As I see it, developing this whole level 3 response comes out of your general fund and capital. It's a capital project. When it comes to maintenance, you'll be able to start to calculate how much it costs each year, and that will determine how you develop your environmental fee for the yard. And that, so that if the maintenance becomes excessive, well, that you will have to change the cost of the yard to do that, and the buildings and whatever, to pay for that. So that's where the environmental fee married to the maintenance will take care of that, the cost of that.
And it may take us, a couple of 2-3 years to like right now, we don't know how often we're going to have to replace the media and the totes.
Right.
At some point it becomes saturated, but is that 6 months, a year, 18 months? There'll be trial and error and testing.
CJ?
Well, on that maintenance activity, what are the components of that? The media, the labor, and the disposal. Is there anything else?
That's it.
Can you predict the unit cost for each of those three?
Certainly. The only unknown is the schedule.
Yeah. Well, you scale the quantity.
Absolutely.
You have a maximum slope and a minimum slope, and it's somewhere in between.
We could also put together a predictive calculator that with a cost escalator what the media replacement is going to be. So, for example, we could ascribe a 2.5% or 5% annual cost escalator to it. We know it's $600 a yard now. We could budget for what it might be if it makes it to 5 years. Based on a 5% per annum increase in cost at 5 years, now we know, we'll know the volumes that will need to be replaced, but we can make an educated guess based on pollutant load off of one building. So, that's easily enough.
It'll be better than an educated guess.
Yeah. It'll be catch basin maintenance that we'll have to do periodically.
Certainly.
Just like we do now on all the catch basins. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a huge cost, it's just that we need to recognize that there will be an additional maintenance cost as we go into the future years.
But we'd like to see what it is. It doesn't show here. As good as this is, it doesn't show in the forecast call.
Yep.
Well, this is a sketch for this workshop. We'll dial those numbers in a little better here.
You know we want more.
Yeah, we've got till May of next spring to get all this work done. So I would recommend, if you like this format, if you want more information, we can change the format, but maybe every couple of months we kind of update this as we move along.
That would be great. One question I have is, the last time we discussed this, the figure was $370,000, and now it's almost $60,000 more than the last time we discussed this. So where did that extra $60,000 come from?
Going through the general ledger and getting a more complete understanding of what the costs are to data, I was able to make some adjustments to the pending level 3 response costs. So
it wasn't one or two particular things. It was
no. And in fact, there's a good chance that the shipyard resurfacing project's going to cost substantially less. But I'm putting in here a pretty generous, factor in there for unknowns at this point.
Okay.
But this includes a lot of labor.
Yeah, labor wasn't included before.
Last time we discussed that this was outside contract services we were approving, not poor labor.
Right.
This includes everything. That's what we went back to Al and said, what did allocate? How much it cost internally to?
Okay.
So you like the format?
Yeah, I do.
It's easy to understand.
Yeah,
I'd say maybe every other month, give a chance for enough work to be done to build a meaningful report. So we'll update it and provide it to you.
So I did have a question on the actual physical stuff, and this says Sims Way sand filter rehabilitation and work completed, then we also have the Sims Way sand filter repair. So is that the same sand filter?
No, yes it is. The difference there being that what we tried to affect in the rehabilitation of the Simsway sand filter, which you see under work completed, is we tried to utilize the in-place infrastructure that we have, which is simply a impermeable membrane, a pond liner, basically. We tried to get the hydraulics right for contact time with the filter media, the biochar in this case. We couldn't get it dialed in the way we wanted to. Even with far less than optimum hydraulics in place there, we're still seeing a 75% reduction in zinc. So we knew that the media was working really well. Now we needed to fine-tune the hydraulics. So that's why we just on Monday took delivery of the two totes, if you will, 4 foot by 4 foot, 24 foot aluminum constructed totes that will replace the filter that's there now. So we will hard plumb the outfall pipe from the I forget what basin number that is, but the Simsway basin, drainage basin there.
That will get tanks under the sand filter there.
That's right. Yeah. So we'll hard plumb for that so that we can, you know, really control the amount of contact time with the filter media. And we'll probably see upwards of a 90% reduction there for those. Now that Simsway drainage basin is only 11% of the total drainage basin areas, or the sum of all the basin areas, but it's the highest pollutant load. And we've had to try to, you know, find that sweet spot, if you will, and cost benefit of where we're going to affect these costly changes in the way that we control the stormwater. So that seemed to us to be a very obvious place to invest our money and time.
And those tanks were produced by the co-op, so the money stayed locally.
So that work that we did in the ground then is going to be like the sand filter in the yard. It's just going to stay there, but we're going to actually just bypass it by a hard pipe and then just use the totes, right?
In the case of where we've applied the biochar, we're going to salvage that char. Since it really hasn't been utilized. So we'll put that aside. That will go into the tote that we put in, or the tank that will go in place. On the other Simsway filter, there's two legs to that. Then we'll remove all the sand there, put the tote in. Then we have another...
So the tote's going to be buried.
That's correct.
Yeah,
they'll be proud of grade by, I think, 12 inches. So
the edge of the tank will?
That's right. Right. So we had to factor in for storm surge. Yeah. So we had to have some level of capacity within.
So is this going to have any kind of fence or guard or vehicular restraints or anything?
I don't think it'll need one.
But it's going to be like an edge of a tank sticking up, right, where people are pedestrians
it is,
are walking.
It is, but we did we knocked down the edge of that. We put in we made some design changes to it to make it safer. So, I mean, currently right now it's a
trench. Yeah, I know what it looks like. No, it's a dip there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Roots sticking up and everything else from the trees.
So we have we did notice that we've invited a small forest of new shoots from those poplars out there. They're popping up in the ballasted area of the shipyard now from the root disturbance that we cause. So they are some of the most vigorous trees I've ever seen.
So the size and engineering, you know, so I've asked this question before about the future paving of the yard and the fact that doing so is going to mean altering the stormwater flow and dramatically increase the quantity. Is any planning or any look at the size of these particular units, has that been taken into consideration?
No, because that would require such extensive re-engineering of the whole system. Those totes would be almost immaterial to what we would need to do. It'd be a complete rethinking philosophically of how we managed our stormwater. So I don't think...
So that's another project for another day then?
I think you're going to have to get past the breakwater project first because...
That'll be a big project. A couple million
probably. And I mean, I'm not avoiding that consideration. I think that maybe we'll have to tackle that eventually, but doing that right now would definitely push you up against your your financial capacity.
Well, understood, but I would like to really see this begin the planning process for paving this yard as soon as we can accommodate that.
Can you give me till May 31st? Start on that one.
Yeah.
I've updated the, I've updated the level 3 response plan there, so apologies for the small formatting, but that'll carry me through till May 31st, and I'm pretty confident we'll meet the benchmarks, and as soon as we do, then I'll start thinking about asphalt.
All right. Fair enough.
Thank and what you. We should do as we develop our long-range capital plan, that should be in there.
Yeah.
You know, pick a year when you want to, you know, think about it, plan it.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be a multi-year project.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even once we get it all permitted and engineered, we still, the actual construction might be phased in over 2 to 3 summers, you know, just so we keep the boatyard active. And
yeah.
Not destroy
it. Maybe even longer.
Yep. All right, well, we'll bring this back to you.
Oh, two hands. Vigo, you haven't said anything yet.
Just a quick point of clarification. Al, what are you going to do with those poplars? Are you going to eradicate them? Or
I was just going to mention, when I first got here, I was called Chainsaw Crockett in the leader. Because I brought up that issue that these trees, they're short-lived. On the average, they live about 80 years.
Yeah.
They're very brittle. They tend to rot from the inside out, so they might look okay, but they're not. And with the power lines and a high-traffic highway and our boatyard, yeah, you don't wait till they start falling down in the winter windstorm. You start taking them down in an orderly fashion and put some suitable, I suggested cherry trees, and I was taking a test for that. I don't like cherry trees, and you do something that won't interfere with all these things. So it's a big question. We took those two down by the brewery because they were cracking the floor inside the brewery.
But they're so pretty in the fall.
But here's the reason I asked the question.
Dirty.
I'm no arborist, but in my opinion, you ought to get rid of as many of those trees as you can. I helped this elderly lady with her septic system, and you can't believe how vigorous the roots are in that tree. 30 plus feet from the tree, the roots are over 3 inches in diameter. They filled her entire drainage system. So where there's liquid, they're going to suck it up. And you've got this very expensive system, and guess what? In 10 years, the roots will be everywhere.
Well, if it can get through 3/4 plate aluminum.
Okay. But I'm just saying that they can.
I'm there with you. I'll donate the chainsaw.
on that, by the way, for those who came after, is that originally, of course, that was the poplars were the lining for the driveway to the Eisenbeis mansion. And Castle Hill, there's a picture of the old Eisenbeis house, and that was, of course, this was their driveway, and they had this poplar lined colonnade that you drove through to get up to it, and the entrance to town was down on 19th where the motorcycle shop is.
Wow.
And when they dredged the port, to dredge it out, they threw it in the Kai Tai Lagoon and filled it in. And the salt killed all the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big uproar about that. So they widened Sims Way and replanted, H.J. Carroll, they replanted those poplars again. And I only say that because you may find that you have a historical committee who feels very strongly that this is an identity. And you should take a look at that picture sometime in the Manresa.
It's in the Manresa Castle?
Yeah, it's in the hallway there. You can see that picture. And
we've got the photos from the 60s when the dredging was happening, and you can see where they, they're just little specks, in the aerial. And but yeah, I fought that battle once 15 years ago, and I haven't done it since, but we need to do it again.
I have some Cork Park elm to donate to the port.
Yeah.
To replace them.
Okay, so we've rung out that level 3 response financials. Thank you, Al.
Thank you.
You can stay if you want.
Fine. Fine. Thank you.
Okay, presentation and discussion on policy versus operations.
Yeah, this really revolves around our two-touch philosophy to our business meetings and everything. So Eric has put together a little tutorial here for all of us. These two different ones? Yep.
Yes.
And then, I guess my goal as your director is to make sure you're comfortable with how we run our business meetings and what really deserves a two-touch system and what things, just from a pure operational, just to keep the train moving, we can do a little bit quicker. And it all gets down to, what is policy, versus operation. So, Mr. Eric.
Sure. Well, maybe just a brief bit of background on kind of the genesis of the first and second reading approach to organizing agenda items. I think you'll find that that's really grounded principally in general purpose governments that adopt policies and regulations of general effect, with the expectation being that before adoption of ordinances, regulations, that the public have a full and fair opportunity to be involved in commenting on those policy and regulatory proposals. That's not to say that it doesn't have applicability in a special purpose government setting like our own, but the main concern here is that, number one, the public have an opportunity to participate fully in the decisions made by the Commission, and also that the Commission faithfully exercise its fiduciary responsibility in protecting the public interest. So I've prepared just a couple of very basic handouts, one that kind of sets forth the basic distinction between the Commission role and the management role, trying to help clarify kind of that fiduciary role that the Commission exercises versus the kind of implementation role, the operations and management role that that staff fulfill. So that's that first handout that's entitled the Commission Executive Management Relationship. And the second handout is in essence just kind of trying to capture not all, but a good cross-section of the types of decisions that would typically come before, or action items that would come before the Commission, and which of those action items would typically require broader public input in the form of a first and second reading versus those that, because of their magnitude and the fact that they're sort of closer to day-to-day operations decisions, would that one touch would be sufficient. There's no bright line, really, to distinguish, what is appropriate for broader public input in the form of a first and second reading versus only one reading. So there's obviously some discretion involved. I think you will find that in many instances, items historically have been brought to the Commission by staff multiple times, simply because staff wants the advice, counsel, and input of the Commission, even though it may have been a decision that, the standpoint of looking at your fiduciary responsibility, may not have required first and second readings. So just looking at that second table, the one entitled Commission Agendas, Decisions, One Touch or Two Touches, what we'll see is that in the main, most of these big decisions, approval of larger expenditures, Certainly that the annual resolution where you have over the past number of years adopted basically a delegation of management authority to the executive director, the meetings where you're kind of organized or taking action to organize your own procedures and meeting times and process, those are all two-touch real property decisions, certainly all budgetary decisions, and adoption of formal policies in the way of your formal strategic plan and also your capital improvement program. All of those are things that should, candidly, in many instances, require more than a first and second reading, but, you know, be subject to a number of public meetings to flesh those matters out. I think the area where perhaps we've been hung up a little bit is in these instances where we have expenditures that exceed the executive director's spending authority of $15,000 that's in the delegation of authority, but are nevertheless part of kind of ongoing day-to-day operations and in many instances a program or a project that has been previously reviewed and endorsed by the commission. So I think what we're proposing here is that for basically expenditures between $15,001 and $99,999, that those decisions would require one touch. They're going to come before you because they exceed the executive director's delegation of authority, but they're of a scope and magnitude and represent a relatively small percentage of the port's budget and therefore are not the type of decision that would rise to a level requiring multiple public meetings.
Can I give an example of that?
Sure.
As we speak, we had planned to replace the metal roof on Susie's place, coffee place. You know, that's going to be more than $15,000. You know, so you would need to approve that, but that's almost a maintenance item that we had planned a year ago to do this year. You know, it's not going to have an impact on the public in general or anything, so just to keep the contract going, as soon as we get the bids in, you know, do a one touch and move on.
Well, is that part of the level three response?
No, totally separate.
So it's not a zinc issue?
No. Yeah. It's a leak issue. Lots of leaks.
And it's been in our, you know, we've been slowly replacing those roofs over the years, mm-hmm. all the old Sperry buildings, so.
And, you know, just as an aside, I don't want to get, you know, too off in the weeds here, but, you know, I think there's broad agreement at the staff level at the comments that CJ had earlier, and the need certainly to do a better job in defining the capital projects that are going to be pursued in the upcoming year. And that once those are detailed and have been the subject of budget hearings and discussions before the commission and a part of the adopted budget, that when the work is undertaken to actually implement those projects, what's coming before the commission in that instance is really a warrant for approval because the project has been approved. The other item that you'll see in this table is, you know, the approval of rules and regulations. And this is something that we've discussed a bit at the staff level as well. The what the delegation indicates is that the executive director has the authority to adopt rules and regulations governing port properties, provided they are consistent with commission policy. So I think the parking issue is a good example. I think what we find in many instances is that there is no overarching port policy to provide direction for what the rules and regulations implementing that policy should be. And in those instances, I think you should fairly expect that staff is going to bring those those issues to you and indicate a need for policy clarification before developing rules and regulations to implement that direction. The reason it's indicated as not applicable here is that in your delegation of authority, basically, and in the rules and regs themselves, I think it's set up so that provided it's consistent with your direction, the process is that the executive director promulgates those rules and then reports any changes or amendments once annually to the commission. So, provided it's consistent with your policy. So I think that's the real key issue here. So, I guess in sum, leases, thank you, Jim. We're proposing that approval of lease agreements, which again is, I wouldn't call it ministerial, but it's very much closer to kind of operations decision making than, major, a public policy decision affecting the general public. Those would be appropriate for one touch or one reading before the commission. I should also say that with respect to just the expenditure limit that we've identified here of $99,999 versus $100,000, that's consistent with the triple bottom line checklist that was developed several years ago by the port that seeks to distinguish when significant programmatic action or project action necessitates review and recommendation by the Port Strategic Advisory Committee. So we're trying to make it consistent with that as well. So I guess in sum, what we're trying to do is to ensure that those matters that really do affect public policy and are of a magnitude and scope that require multiple airings in a public setting be identified and subject to that scrutiny, but that we don't include decisions that are kind of more routine and necessary for the efficient day-to-day operations and functioning of the port, because we obviously would hope to, in the instance of like the roof of Sunrise Coffee, do that in a more expeditious fashion than over the course of a month and two public meetings in front of the commission.
Thank you, Rick.
Remember, a lot of that, especially when you're going out for bid on these smaller projects, like, they'll give us they'll respond saying we'll do it for $18,000. This price is good for 2 weeks. If it's going to take us 30 days to get a decision, you may end up having to pay more money too. So,
how about on the rules and regs, like the parking example, where there is no policy? So if we leave it in gray, how do we determine whether we're going to go one touch or two touch on that?
Well,
it seems like the one area that could be a little bit.
In fact, you'll have an example this afternoon in the business meeting, because using my delegation of authority as it's currently written, I'm instituting a 72-hour rule for parking. Mm-hmm. And, according to the delegation, I can do that, but I should, in a timely fashion, report it to the commission. So that's what I'm doing this afternoon. And if that's something that you feel you would rather have a little bit tighter control on, then when we do the annual review of the delegation of authority and that sort of thing, tweak it and change it. But, it's parking is only one asset, factor of rules and regs, and so you got to be careful.
I think what we're likely to find out is that in many instances, the issues that arise that benefit from a new rule or regulation, we simply don't have applicable policy. Mm. And in that instance, what I would think would be the protocol would be that staff would come to the commission, identify the issue, identify a suggested policy proposal to remedy that at one meeting, have at the next meeting the commission review, discuss, revise, approve such policy direction, and that be that we keep track of those, that we have a clear link between the rules and regulations that we promulgate and the explicit direction of the commission. Now, it wouldn't be the expectation that the commission is going to, you know, get down into the weeds and develop necessarily the specifics of the regulation, but that the general guidance certainly come from the commission.
Well, your insurance for independent contractors is one of those perfect examples. We have no direction from the commission. So you direct us, we will come up with a rule of regulation regarding that. Why not?
But I think even going a step further than we have thus far, for instance, in that instance, would be to actually develop a proposed policy for the commission to consider, revise, adopt, so rather than just a voice vote recorded in the minutes.
So where is the resurrection of the Strategic Advisory Committee? Where is that?
Because we don't have any new capital projects. Well, I think we have a committee formed now. We have individuals who have agreed to serve. We have not convened them thus far because, in the main, we don't have new capital projects that were not anticipated already or even recommended by the committee last year for them to weigh in on or inclusion in the upcoming budget process. That's not to say that we don't still intend to convene.
Well, what I'm coming from is like, you know, making an amendment, if you will, to our one-touch or two-touch system is something that I would appreciate hearing from the advisory committee on their opinion regarding that.
Regarding the one-touch, two-touch?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you're going to make changes to that, then you don't have any input, fine.
Yeah, again, just to be clear, I mean, the one-touch, two-touch that we have now is really a product of the commission resolution, I think, from mm-hmm. January of this mm-hmm. year.
Understood.
And what we're really doing is talking about clarifying that decision. I don't see this as like turning that prior decision on its ear in any way. Mm-hmm. We certainly could, bring this before the advisory committee and continue on as we have been pending recommendation from the advisory committee, but we don't have a meeting with them scheduled at this point.
Okay. Because I think, I like broadly what you've done here. Listen, Derek. One thing I think that might be useful for the PSAC committee to understand is that in my mind, there's two reasons for two touch. One is so that us guys as commissioners have a little bit of time to think about this thing and weigh all the evidence and the public testimony and all the stuff we have instead of just shoot from the hip. But the other thing is to inform the public. And that's, in my mind, the main thing, and that, in my mind, came from the PSAC. And so it'd be useful if they have a chance to weigh in on it. And I think that the two touches, the touch actually has to be defined as a touch, meaning that it's actually so the public can be informed. A touch means it has to be published in the agenda,
right.
Not added at the last minute where the public would have no idea that that was to be discussed, and then that wouldn't really constitute a touch.
Yep.
So in other words, I agree with Brad that I think it's something that the PSAC would like to get their teeth into a little bit and maybe help us define what is going to be involved. I agree with this myself, but the PSAC may have some other things to say.
I have to say I disagree with you guys. I think the PSAC is really here to comment on capital projects, and this, I think what you've done here is really clear, and it gives us a platform to move forward. I think the two-touch to me, yet has not demonstrated one in one issue that, you know, the public hasn't been informed as far as anything we've moved on yet this year. So I think the issue of the public being informed really falls dramatically on the public's responsibility to look at the website, understand what's going on, and comment. And I think more often than not, what I see is that no one really cares. I mean, no one really digs into the website to understand what's going on. I think other issues where we're talking about doing a column in the newspaper, we're revamping the website, we're trying to ramp up our social media to make ourselves more transparent to the public, are a lot more relevant than Two Touch. So I think this is great. This is a great move forward. I think it'll help clarify for the staff what they can move forward with without being too cumbersome, particularly with the $15,000 to $100,000 decision on projects.
And so what did you disagree with on this?
Nothing. No, I don't disagree with this. I disagree with bringing PSAC in because I think it'll just slow the process down of us getting this adopted and saying, yeah, that's great. I mean, we're not changing anything except saying, for these guys, if they need to make a decision between $15,000 and $100,000, they're good to go on that. And my fear is we bring PSAC in and they want to talk about it. Just trying to get clarity on that one point is going to slow the whole process down.
Just to be clear, I think that we already have a resolution, and the resolution states that it's policy decisions. And so basically I think what Eric has done is kind of
trying to clarify what that means.
Already here. So in other words, we're not really changing anything. We're just clarifying what we already have.
So what we're saying is that the two dots here and the One Touch are already current policy?
That's what we're saying, but staff's been a little hesitant to do that because we've had, say, a straightforward lease we've had to bring back two times.
Right.
And you got the business owner sitting there for a month wanting to get started in the business.
And reviewing the actual resolution that we have, we discovered that it said policy, and so
right.
That excludes these things. And so basically what Eric did is define what we have already got in place. But I really think, to me, this revival of the Two Touch, which happened when I became the president because I had to approve it, and it had been instituted earlier but then not really used a lot, was as a direct result of the PSAC. I mean, you know, they had this recommendation and I agreed with them, and so I wanted to make sure that the public was informed, and so that basically made the resolution be brought to the forefront again, and we started doing this again. But now what Eric has done is clarify what the resolution actually says, and I think this is a good clarification of that. So basically, we don't have to do anything except that it would be useful the next time we have a PSAC meeting to have them be informed of what it really means and see if they have any comments on it.
I agree.
I thought we were making a decision that, like, lease agreements and expenditures would be One Touch.
No. Yep. CJ, did you have something, or did we answer that?
I think that was good definition and a pretty good piece of work, Eric. With respect to the increment between $15,000 and $99,000, I think that that's acceptable to me as long as you can point to a line item in the budget, not just because staff says, well, it's in the budget. But if you can point to a real line item in the budget for that increment of expenditure that says, we plan to do this and we're moving ahead with it. And I guarantee you can't do that right now. If you can do it next year, then I think that that's a very good increase. Well, it's not really an increase in the level of authority because all they're doing is administering the budget. The $15,000, from my understanding, is the executive director's discretionary authority to spend money that is not in the budget and not allocated. Is that correct?
Yeah. It tends to be quite often maintenance related. You know, Larry Ozzie will call me up saying, hey, the furnace is crapped out down at the Shanghai building. We need to replace it. Yeah, it's going to be $8,000. I can just say, we'll do it. You know.
Well,
but that's it.
But when you start talking about an exceedance of that, then it needs to be something that is already a line item in the budget. And they shouldn't even have to come to you. They should just inform you. You should have a budget that works that well. It should be backed up by a maintenance plan that says what needs to be done, and that should be supported by a comprehensive plan for capital expenditures that really means something. And I'm anxious to hear about when you guys expect to have your new comprehensive plan draft available for public review.
Comprehensive plan as far as the RCW goes, which we just updated.
You're making reference to a comprehensive
budget
capital improvement program that's reflected in the budget.
Yeah. The comp plan has another legal definition.
I'll see you.
Yeah. Well, that's part of our budget process. We're going to present drafts to you probably second meeting in September and be looking for input.
I would point out that even though things are not like in the budget, when they look at the financials, we spent $132,000 more in this first 6 months for A&G than you did last year. And that is a significant chunk of money that you're going to need for the stormwater and the jetty. So I just would urge the commission to really take a close look at that, because that's just in 6 months, $132,000. That's big.
And a big part of that increase is not allocating salaries out to every project and department, and keeping the administrative salaries in administration and then allocating it out through the A&G allocation.
Well, that's where having the various report is really helpful, explaining such things. That way it's clear and not confusing.
You know, just as an aside, this is really interesting. Larry Ozzie and I have gotten together a couple of times over the last month, because he's sought basically some help in pulling together his recommendations to the executive director for what the maintenance budget should be. And what we ended up doing is essentially sitting down and identifying the potential universe of projects, just projects first, without reference to whether they would be capital projects or necessarily routine maintenance and operations projects. And then went for each of the major facilities, Point Hudson, Boathaven, and Quilsing. And then took each project, provided just sort of a rough order of magnitude cost estimate for them, and then determined whether they would, based on that, exceed $15,000 and therefore, at least in our estimation, need to be capitalized versus kept over on the operations side of the budget. And then ran all of the projects through our that exceeded that $15,000 threshold through that matrix that we brought before you some months ago, to just see how, at least in his estimation, he would rank them. And that's been a really interesting and instructive process, and I think one that can help us achieve the object, ultimately, of getting a much more detailed line item capital budget that kind of identifies with some specificity precisely what we're going to undertake in the upcoming year, where the funds for that project are coming from, and so that we can kind of better track what it is that we're doing. It's a very, as CJ has indicated on a number of occasions, a very useful planning tool, and it makes very real the commission's budget process. It really is a planning process.
And a lot of that's based on our site visits that we did earlier.
Just to comment on that, I think I was a little taken aback that there is a lot to do. as we walk, like through Point Hudson and Coolsing and kind of, I think, going on CJ's comments too, that's good to hear. Because it seemed like I wasn't hearing anything really concrete from Larry that, yeah, we're going to get to that.
Yeah. Well, see,
some point down the line.
It's really difficult for Larry because, in many respects, the maintenance is, and this is not meant in any way as demeaning, they're the duct tape and baling wire crew. They are trying to keep things burbling along here, running. And most of the projects that we talk about, and then we look at Larry, the expectation that his crew will remedy these issues are really capital projects. They're not routine, ongoing operations and maintenance projects. And so I think getting some clarity on what routine maintenance is and what the budget for routine maintenance is versus those larger projects that are more disruptive and longer term and more expensive is really critical to doing a better job in identifying the order of magnitude costs and tracking those costs as we move forward. But the commission, I think, is going to have some really difficult decision making because the potential universe of projects is large, and the available resources to address those issues is small.
I think that's really true, Eric, but I also think it's the good news is getting all of the bad news in front of us. Mm-hmm. So we have an adequate picture of what, and that was my sense doing the walkthroughs is I sensed a little bit of confusion on Larry's part, again, not criticizing Larry at all, but just the magnitude, like Point Hudson is a good example. I mean, you're dealing with this crumbling 80-year-old structure. And so I think it's great news to get the bad news.
Yeah.
So we've got a good idea.
I mean, and I don't want to get us wildly off course here, but I think one of the things that Larry and I have noticed is that, he knows a lot. He's been here for as long as anyone, and he, I think, understands kind of the condition of work facilities very well. But there's a lot that he doesn't know, and that would require engineering assessments to better clarify kind of the risk, the order of magnitude replacement cost, and the likely lifespan of both existing facilities and their replacements.
And we're not alone.
Yeah, no, we're not.
If you talk to your counterparts in other board districts, back in the 60s and 70s, those were the heydays of construction along the waterfront. All the marinas were built back then. There hasn't been a new marina built in decades. But everything is coming to the end of their lifespan, and what do?
Okay, well, thank you for your comments.
I have one other thing as far as the format of a business meeting, and it's not a big one, but a lot of times staff just wants to provide an update on something. It's not really a first touch or second touch. We're not looking for any decision now or in the future. We just want to let you know that, hey, remember this thing that was going on with Fish and Wildlife 10 months ago? Well, here's what happened. How do you want us to, from a format perspective, put that on the agenda?
Well, I don't see why we couldn't just have staff updates. I mean, the first and second touch is for stuff that's going to require, decisions, and then staff updates just keeping us informed so that when it does require a decision, we'll have some...
Just on the thing, because if you want another line in the agenda, we actually have to change that's something you do every January, is change the format of the meeting.
So. Do you see that as different than staff comments?
Well, that's the other thing. Or do you just want us to lump it in staff comments?
Why not?
Yeah, which is fine with me, too. It's...
I think a good example of that on this afternoon's is actually the financials.
Yeah.
It's a staff update. It doesn't really fall under the staff comment, but it's not a first touch or second touch either.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, just something to think about.
Okay. So is there any other comments for this workshop?
So we'll adjourn this workshop and reconvene at a meeting this afternoon.